Jihad Radio, a radio show going all out for truth. I've been seeking the truth about a lot of things, especially the big false flag event on September 11, 2001, for well over a decade now, and there's no sign of letting up. We're still plowing ahead, and literally plowing ahead here in Wisconsin. We're in the middle of a blizzard, getting maybe a foot or so of snow, it looks like. So I might as well stay inside and talk to one of my favorite 9/11 researcher authors, and that is Mark Gaffney. He's the author of Black 9/11, Money, Motive, and Technology. It's one of the books that definitely belongs on the bookshelf of anybody who's seriously interested in 9/11. And Mark has a new article out that he published at Information Clearinghouse. It's called 9/11, A Wilderness of Mirrors and the Prince of Darkness. That obviously must be a reference to Richard Pearl, the self-proclaimed Prince of Darkness. I guess his role models are Machiavelli and Satan. Not necessarily in that order. So let's hear about it from the man himself. Welcome, Mark Gaffney. How are you?
Real good, Kevin. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you back. So this is a really interesting article. You're kind of peeling back some of the onion layers on the power structure that made 9/11 happen and, you know, speculating on who was really in the loop here. Tenet lying before the 9/11 commission. Richard Pearl skulking around behind the scenes, obviously one of the movers and shakers of the neocon ultra-Zionist team that was probably behind 9/11. This is a really great article, so congratulations, and let's go ahead and introduce it.
Sure. If anybody has any, has a question, if they're wondering why people call Richard Pearl the Prince of Darkness, I would simply suggest you go take a look at a photograph of him.
Yeah. He could play Nosferatu in one of those, you know, Werner, what's his name, Herzog horror movies.
Yeah.
Well, you could see the guy literally. He would look appropriate drinking blood.
Yeah. You can almost imagine horns coming out of his head, you know.
Imagine. I think all you have to do is pull his hair back a little bit. You'd see him.
Yeah.
Can't make this stuff up. Pearl is this ultra Zionist. So he's for some reason he actually cares about one thing other than himself, I guess, and that is that Israel should continue to commit genocide. But he's also a big time wheeler and dealer and mover and shaker in the military money arena.
That's right. And apparently had to withdraw from the advisory board soon. It wasn't long after 9/11 for conflict of interest. He was undoubtedly has investments in the military sector, you know.
Yeah. And Sybil Edmonds, as I recall, either said or hinted that he might be involved in that American-Turkish committee, American-Azerbaijan committee that she said were involved in the dark money, the probably heroin fueled money part of it that was involved in 9/11.
Well, I'd like to learn more about that. I really not privy to that information.
Yeah, that's another thread that kind of intersects with some of yours. Uh-huh. But let's go over some of the threads that you're tracing in this article.
Okay. Well, I think Tenet is this guy who was basically shell shocked. You know, after 9/11 happened, he was kind of clueless. Whatever role he may have played, he was definitely out of the loop and about, you know, a lot of what happened. And I would suggest that his number three man, Buzzy Krongard, was probably more in the loop than Tenet was. He was, as we know, he was involved in the insider trading and probably
he released his bank. Deutsche Bank was his former.
Yes,
bank.
He was. Well, he was the he was at Deutsche. He had been at Deutsche Bank. His protege was still there, you know, the other one who resigned on September the 12th. Mm-hmm. But
convenient timing.
Without any explanation.
Yeah. Yeah, like, oops, well, maybe we shouldn't have bought all those put options. This may not look good.
And apparently, from what I understand, those put options were somebody picked up the money afterwards. They were cashed in, according to this a researcher up in State University of New York, Buffalo. I'm trying to think of his name. Begins with a Z.
Oh, Zaremka.
Zaremka, yeah. Zaremka told me that he believed the put options were paid out.
Really? So interesting. Because, you know, the official version is, of course, that they weren't.
That's right. But we know that the SEC basically tabled its investigation at a certain point. They just said, oops, can't go any further with this.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those areas that has been, you know, signed, sealed, and certified as authentic by people, you know, who were not considered part of the conspiracy world. There was a professor, I think, at the University of Illinois who did a very in-depth study, a guy who's an expert on stock market trading, and did a very detailed study and concluded, yeah, this was insider trading.
Well, there were three studies, as to my knowledge, three academic studies, and they all concluded that.
Okay. I guess I just saw one.
Yeah, there's three of them, and wow, they all agreed that there had been insider trading. Zaremka estimated the payout was somewhere around $35 or $40 million.
Mm-hmm.
And this SEC had the paper trail and all of that. You know, these puts have paper trails, so they know who did these trades, and they just buried it. And, you know, when David Callahan did a FOIA, tried to get the records for this SEC's investigation, he got a letter from the SEC, said, oops, sorry, all those records were destroyed.
Yeah, must have been a mistake there. Somebody turned on the shredder at the wrong moment or something.
Yeah.
The papers just fell in there.
Yeah. And all this kind of just fell into the, you know, the memory hole. Nobody remembers what happened.
Yeah, well, when Dennis Kucinich promised a number of leaders of the 9/11 truth movement, and I was not on the front line of that, but I was consulting behind the scenes with a couple of these people who actually had very serious meetings with Dennis Kucinich. He promised to have a congressional investigation of the put options. And then in the following year, like three people close to him, I think his sister and who else, people started dropping dead.
Really? And I didn't hear about that.
Yeah. So the speculation, I mean, he wouldn't talk to us after that. So, you know, yeah, who knows?
And then he was, apportioned out of the House when they changed his district.
You know, yeah. They redistricted.
So he
was one of those people like Cynthia McKinney that they couldn't tolerate
so
being
he got
in
rid
the
of
House.
Him.
Yeah,
that's right. And this stuff that goes on behind the scenes, you know, it just makes your hair stand on end, and the average American has no idea.
Yeah. We imagine that these third world dictatorships, the banana republics, are incredibly corrupt. Little do we imagine how bad it is here. It's worse here. Yeah.
Well, so, I need to tell you the motivation for this article. I finally came to the conclusion. I mean, I had known this for quite a while. I'd suspected it, but came to the conclusion that a Mossad team probably planted the explosives in the World Trade Center. And I think we just have to go after them. I think we have to expose them on this. I think we have to break through. And this is big enough that it could break through if we could, you know, if we could get, you know, dig deep enough.
Okay, now let's back up on that one a second, because, okay, my listeners are fully aware that some form of explosive was used to demolish the three World Trade Center towers, and the Israelis are at the very top of the list there. We have all kinds of reasons to suspect them, from the team that was there documenting the event, meaning they knew there was an event to document by their own admission, and got arrested, clearly a Mossad team, to items of evidence like Susan Lindauer testifying that her CIA controller was on the phone with her on the morning of 9/11, watching the buildings being blown up, and he started screaming. His name is Richard Fuse, by the way. He started screaming about the goddamn Israelis. Clearly, he knew that the goddamn Israelis had blown up the World Trade Center, and he knew that on the morning of 9/11. He and Lindauer and other CIA people knew it, that it was coming. They just didn't know the details. So this is just a tiny fraction of what we know pointing in that direction. Now, if you were going to be taking this to some higher authority, what would you point at as the best evidence that the Israelis and or their intelligence services were behind the demolition of the buildings?
Well, there's a number of points. Obviously, all that evidence surrounding the dancing Israelis, you know, there were many that were arrested and then quietly exported, deported to Israel later. Evidence of foreknowledge there, you know, and this, mm-hmm. a lot of people acknowledge that much. And then you have the relationship between Larry Silverstein and Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, that to me, that is really, really significant.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Netanyahu had been in New York's He was in New York City. I think he was Israel's ambassador to the UN. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But anyway, when he was in New York, he got to know Larry Silverstein very well. The two men were close. They talked every week. And I think you have the makings of a an understanding right there.
Absolutely. And with Silverstein being on record admitting to the demolition of Building 7 and having profited mightily from these demolitions, the fact that he's so close to Netanyahu is a pretty big smoking gun.
It's a very short list of suspects, Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this needs to be investigated. You know, I think we need to dig into this and see what we can find.
Yeah. Well, the people that I've gotten to know over at Veterans Today, this group of folks, some of them have kind of checkered backgrounds, but some insider connections. It's just taken for granted in that world that the Israelis did 9/11 with their sort of neocon Zionist insider team. And, you know, this is, it's not a secret. It's a little bit like Cossiga, the former president of Italy, said. He said, everybody knows this.
Yeah.
Everybody in the intelligence community in Europe knows that the Israelis and their American friends did 9/11. It's a world's worst kept secret.
Except for that Americans don't
yeah,
have a clue.
We'll be the last ones to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, you know, our countrymen, you know, this country we live in, the Americans, they're almost like sheep, you know, being led to slaughter. I mean, they're like babes in the woods surrounded by wolves, and they seem almost helpless.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also that taboo protecting this whole topic. I mean, for one thing, of course, you know, thinking about 9/11 being, it wasn't our enemies, the people that we've been told were our enemies. It was like us plus our Israeli friends. This is all very frightening to a lot of folks, and especially the Israeli angle, because we're brainwashed from infancy to believe that Jews are always and forever victims, and Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East, and the Arabs and Palestinians and Muslims are evil terrorists. And you know, getting outside of that programming appears to be fairly difficult for a lot of people.
Let me tell you what kind of tipped me over on this. You know, I had kind of suspected this for a long time, but I didn't want to go there. You know, it's just so disturbing, you know, I mean, even when you know that this is likely what happened, to talk about it, to do research on it, it's disturbing. But when I read that book by Michael Collins Piper, Final Judgment, you know, he had done such excellent research in there that I got to the point where I just couldn't not go there anymore.
And Final Judgment is about the JFK assassination.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
and he's found a significant Israeli connection to the JFK assassination. And even if that wasn't the only connection, I don't think it was.
No,
if I were going to point at a single agency, I would say it's the CIA for that. But as Piper points out, you know, what is the CIA? It's full of all of these wheeler dealers and, you know, conniving, you know, secret backbiters and arms smugglers. And then you get into the really corrupt side of it, where the organized crime element is overlapping with the
That's
CIA.
Right.
And
That's
what
right.
do you find? You find a whole bunch of Israeli connected people and, you know, right up at the top.
Yes. And I had no idea that Meir Lansky, you know, this Jewish crime boss, head of the syndicate, who hung out with Lucky Luciano and Bugsy Siegel. I had no idea he was the top guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was the banker to the mob. And so, you know, whoever prints the money calls the tune. That's probably why the Rothschilds and their friends are the biggest global power today, and why somebody like him would be the numero uno mobster. Yeah, it's a money power. Yes. And it was interesting that Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence chief, who clearly was involved in the JFK assassination, was the liaison to Israel. And he was so pro-Israeli that I think they gave him medal. I think they even built a statue or something. They gave him huge honors after he stepped down in disgrace as a supposed lunatic. He was chased out of the CIA as a paranoid lunatic.
Right.
But the Israelis lavished honors on him, so it tells you something.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, I think the principle we have to hit on again and again and just try to get across is that these Zionists, they believe that the end justifies the means. And this puts them on the same level as the Bolsheviks and the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the argument we need to use and back it up with many examples.
That's a really interesting point. I think you're onto something there, Mark, because You know, well, that issue of ends and means is so important. Aldous Huxley is one of my favorite writers. I know people in the anti-New World Order movement who think I'm crazy for actually having a positive view of Aldous Huxley.
Well, I do too. I always admired him.
Yeah. No, I think he was a very, very smart, clear thinker. And his book, Ends and Means, goes into this issue. And it's a central issue. And it's not all or nothing. It's not that the world is divided into angels who never, ever let any ends justify means versus demons who always let the ends justify the means. There is a kind of a spectrum in between those two extremes, but it's such a crucial issue. And I think the argument we could make here would be in the intelligence community and the overlapping world of organized crime, high finance, these places where psychopaths gravitate to power and create a psychopathic culture, there's a lot of ends justifying means that goes on. But the Israelis really push this to an extreme, and they unite with this kind of tribal ability to all work together, and so, as if they were like ultra psychopaths compared to everybody else. This is an article that Laurent Guillenot has made, and I'm actually working on translating some more work of his along these lines. He points out that there's a certain way in which we could say that the organized Jewish community, which really means the powerful element in that community, operates against other human communities in the same way that a psychopath operates against other individuals. And so what that really means is that this is a group of people who work together and have pushed the end justifies the means thing, this Machiavellian element that so many of these Zionists admit is their, that's their motto, is to act like that. They push it to a real extreme. So even more than the, you know, a typical CIA wheeler dealer is bad enough, he's yes. going to let some ends justify means occasionally. But these Zionists, they go way over the top. And everybody in the Intelligence Committee knows this. I talk to these people, you know, former black operators in the CIA, and, you know, they all say, yeah, I mean, we're bad, but look at those Israelis.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to you know, use this argument, and they have to be taken down. They have to be... We have to dethrone them, you know, from this being unaccountable. You know, they're not accountable now.
Yeah, they've, well, you know, I think we can look at 9/11 as a coup d'etat that was specifically designed to ratchet up their power. You know, they were, if you trace the history of Zionist power in the USA, it's there. It's a major element going back ever since Zionism or modern Zionism existed, but it gets stronger and stronger. And, you know, it's still kind of modest in the Eisenhower era, when Eisenhower could actually, you know, stab Israel in the back over the that war, the Suez Crisis and stuff with the British, the French and the Israelis teaming up against Egypt. And Eisenhower took the side of Egypt.
That's right.
But, you know, after JFK was assassinated, that was unthinkable. And after,
that's, you know, right. U.S. policy did a 180-degree shift at that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so ever since JFK, the Israelis have been largely in control of their corner of Middle East policy. And I would say with 9/11, they staged a coup d'etat that put them in total control.
Yeah, that's right. And that's exactly right. And so the question is, you know, what do we do about this disaster?
Right, right.
I think we have to go after them.
Yeah. And we have to rally all of the many different types of people, patriots, American patriots, and well-meaning people of all sorts of persuasions and from all sorts of countries to work together on this problem. Well, you, in your article, you are suggesting that George Tenet, the head of the CIA, was kind of bamboozled, and you quote him is saying that after, right after 9/11, or was it even on 9/11, that he ran into Pearl, and Pearl, you know, said, oh, the Iraqis did this, we've got to go after Iraq. And Pearl is like rolling his eyeballs, and she said, well, what are you talking about? What does Iraq have to do with anything?
Yeah.
So there was an indication of, you know, there were really two groups here, the insiders who knew what 9/11 was and what it was designed to accomplish, and then the not quite insiders like Tenet who didn't.
Yes, right.
Yeah. How about Bush? You mentioned that Pearl may have actually met with Bush on 9/11, or on what, the day after, whenever it was.
So Bush's role? Well, I think Bush was mostly mostly in the dark too. But of course, they had to fill him in, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he played an active role, but he probably knew, you know, what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And so when we trace these things, you know, another guy that's actually kind of hard to figure out here is Richard Clarke, who both Tennant and Clarke, if you go back and read what they've written, you can take both of them as being in the realist camp who weren't really on board with the neocons. Although I've gotten some supposed inside information suggesting that Clarke actually was a wolf in sheep's clothing, and may have, you know, according to Gwyneth Todd, who's living in exile in Australia, barely escaped with her life after she stopped a big false flag in Bahrain that was supposed to blame Iran for the slaughter of a bunch of American sailors. Anyway, she says that she worked with Clarke at the National Security Council, and that Clarke has her nomination as the likely mastermind of 9/11. So I don't know if that's true. Yeah, and that, there's a controversy
about
this.
That's kind of surprising.
It is, because both Clarke and Tennant, if you read their stuff post 9/11, they look like they're distancing themselves from the neocons. With Tennant, it's more convincing, for me at least.
Yeah, right.
Clarke, I'm an agnostic on whether he's as bad as Gwyneth says he is. But with Tennant, yeah, as you point out in this article, he's perjuring himself by 2004 at the 9/11 commission hearings. And yeah, maybe you could flesh that out a little bit. You know, how do we know that he was perjuring himself, and why would he have done that?
Well, he must undoubtedly had a lot to cover up, you know, and his own behavior. I'm not prepared to go into the details of it. I'd have to go back and review, the book by Disconnecting the Dots, and the work that Robert Schopmeyer did on this. It's really detailed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't fill my head with a lot of details. You know,
I should probably try to get Schopmeyer on the show.
I've reviewed this data, but I just don't keep it in my head.
Yeah, there's too much of it, really.
Much.
I've been studying this for more than a decade, and you know, at this point, if I jam three facts in one ear, two fall out the other. You know?
I just try to keep the big picture in mind.
Focus
on the important thing and just dig.
Yeah. That's pretty much the way you have to do it. So how about Tennant and his relationship with Prince Bandar?
Oh, well, there's another suspicious relationship, you know, a very close relationship. Apparently Tennant used to drive over to Bandar's estate in McLean, Virginia, which is just down the road from Langley, you know, and hang out there, and they'd probably who knows what they talked about. But I wouldn't even be surprised if it turned out that Bandar's wife, that so-called charitable donation was really a charitable donation. I wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be innocent. I don't know.
You're talking about money that ended up going to the alleged 9/11 hijackers.
That's right. There was a guy in San Diego that was helping two of the hijackers. Apparently, she gave a charitable donation to this guy so that his wife could get some medical treatment. That's the story, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And but further research would either prove that to be true or false, and that research was never done.
Right. Well, I think that if you're keeping the big picture in mind as you look at these kinds of facts, you say to yourself, which is more likely, that this Saudi royal is actually the Saudi government or people in the Saudi government think that it's somehow in their interest to stage something like 9/11 by actually trying to help young Saudis who are going to be hijackers, you know, funding them and all of this? How realistic is that versus the other possibility that this is all a frame-up of the Saudis? That is, that she's conned into giving a charitable donation. These people are a bunch of ditzes who are not paying attention to anything. they throw money.
Well, you're right. That's more plausible.
Yeah. Because seriously, well, for one thing, we know that there weren't any hijackings or hijackers. So these alleged hijackers were just patsies who were set up to take the blame for an operation that used some combination of remote flying and other subterfuge to create the impression that there had been hijacked jetliners
into this discussion, because I'm not in total agreement with you. I have just finished reading Rebecca Roth's book, Methodical Illusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she might be right that there was a switch of those two planes that flew out of Boston. You know what I'm saying?
That's her hypothesis.
She thinks there was a plane switch, and maybe Westover Air Base there in Western Massachusetts was the runway that they used, because air base had been shut down during the week, wasn't being used. It was very close to the flight path of both of those planes. And, you know, I think we need to go back and look at the radar data, because I don't think that a switch would have been perfectly pulled off. I mean, I think there would be some indication. There's a good chance that there'd be some indication in the radar data from 9/11 of that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to accept any of this official data as absolute truth, given that there were all of these war games and exercises going on, which included, you know, inserting fake blips on radar screens, and who knows what forms of seizing control of the various kinds of instruments that were being used. So I wouldn't put full confidence in anything along those lines. But what I would put full confidence in is the very, very obvious and, to my mind, undeniable inference that if you've rigged up for demolition the three biggest, most difficult buildings ever to be demolished in human history, with WTC-7 being almost half again as tall as the tallest skyscraper ever demolished, and the Twin Towers being more than three times as tall as the tallest skyscrapers ever demolished in history, and you're doing this as deceptive demolitions. This is a huge, very, very technical project. And once you've wired all this stuff, for
you
these
can't
demolitions.
Take a chance on some dummy.
You can't let humans take over the planes. Are you kidding? I mean, I have yet to hear anybody even make a serious effort to refute that. And so, just from that alone, we know that there were no human hijackers flying any planes into any targets that day.
Well, see, and this is where I disagree with you. I think that I think these were two separate operations. Because we have black boxes from Flight 77 and Flight 93. We do not have black boxes, at least they claim they were not recovered, from the two that hit the World Trade Center. So I think these were two different things going on here. I believe that the 93, and I think 93 was hijacked. And I think that something went wrong with the remote control, and these bozos in the cockpit were flying all over the countryside. And then they had to resort to a backup contingency plan. And I believe there's evidence, and I've got a, you know, I have an appeal into the NSA right now, pending appeal for the release of infrared satellite data. In October of 2014, the NSA released the infrared satellite data for 9/11. And they supposedly recorded all four impacts or crashes with infrared satellite 23,000 feet up. Okay. Now, this was at the behest of Miles Kara, you know, the former 9/11 commission staffer who did the radar analysis for the commission. He wanted to put to bed any conspiracy theories about Flight 93 and 90 and 77. And what he did was create an opportunity for me, because he did not request, you know, there was a controversy over the crash time of Flight 93. We had a seismic signal at 10:06, and we know that the plane did not crash at 10:06. We know it went down, and it went down at Shanksville. There's no question about
10:03,
that.
10:03, wasn't it?
10:03, yeah. And so what happened at 10:06, okay? So I'm arguing that these were two separate events, 10:03 and 10:06. 10:03 did not create a seismic signal. Plane crashes often do not. The event at the Pentagon did not create a seismic signal. And I believe that was a missile that was deployed there at Shanksville to take down 93. However, it either blew up or crashed before the missile got there. That's what I think happened.
Okay.
So
well,
if I win this NSA appeal, we'll be in a position to go back and take another look at the radar data.
That's very interesting stuff. But I'm still a little... So your hypothesis would be that there are both actual hijackings and then remote control takeovers, and that the planes would be guided into their targets by remote control, correct?
Right. That's right. And I believe with the 757s, they used an override option, and you know, they just flew them remotely into the... Now, this is where I disagree with John Farmer. He was the guy who did processed the Freedom of Information Act request for the radar data, and he obtained that back in 2007. Now, he's convinced that Hani Hunter actually flew that plane into the Pentagon. That's where he and I...
Jeez, he must be just about as stupid as Hani was. I hate to put it bluntly, but I'm telling you,
Frank Legg, you know, one of the editors or former editors of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, he worked with Farmer analyzing that radar data. Mm-hmm. And that is some... He said that, you know, it's not clear. It's not clear what happened. And I still don't agree with him. You know, I still think it was remote control. But anyway, they took a different view of it.
Huh. Yeah. So, I just question, like, okay, so you're going to wire these, assuming you're using commercial planes. Okay, so we're going to do this plot. We're going to fly four commercial planes into various targets, or maybe one of them will do a fake passenger rebellion, whatever the plan was. Why do you even need hijackers, you know? And number two, like, how the hell are hijackers ever going to see? There was not a single successful hijacking in the United States since the 1970s. And there are probably some reasons for that we don't know about, such as the fact that all these planes do have remote backups. That is, if you were to hijack a plane, right, you would quickly find that the pilots couldn't fly it anymore. It would be flown to the nearest landing.
That's
place.
Right. Well, yeah. The hijackers would have been hijacked.
You know? Yeah. So maybe, I mean, I guess you could argue that this could happen if you actually had hijackers, but then another question arises, which, like, okay, let's say that you know, normally if you're doing an operation like this, I would think you would want to get total control of all parameters, and having actual hijackers doesn't really add anything at all to your ability to succeed with your remote hijacking, and it actually might.
Yeah, but you know, Kevin, you have to prepare a cover story, and so the idea that there were hijackers was a cover story.
Right, but it's easier to produce evidence for that if it's fake evidence. That is, it's easier to do fake cell phone calls than to actually try to have somebody place a cell phone call from 30,000 feet, which will never work. So it's much more effective to stage the whole thing in a Hollywood way rather than actually have any reality.
But take a look at the Flight 93, which departed from Newark Airport 41 minutes late. Mm-hmm. Come on. Now, that decision to go out of Newark, I don't think that was the perpetrators. I think the hijackers actually made a decision to fly out of Newark. I think that was a really
good decision. Now, why would that be? What makes you think Newark means hijackers?
Come again?
Well, what does Newark have to do with the likelihood of there being actual hijackers?
Well, in an operation where timing is essential, why would you go out of an airport that has frequent delays like Newark? I mean, the fact that the plane, you know, 93 was 41 minutes late, and, you know, this, how do you figure that into?
Well, why would anyone do that? Why would actual hijackers do that?
Well, because they're stupid, man, because they made a mistake.
Yeah, but if they're that stupid, how the heck are they ever going to seize control of a plane? With box cutters, frankly, I think I could have taken any four of those hijackers myself. And I'm not even a particularly highly trained combat guy. Box cutters? This is ridiculous. The idea that they would succeed in getting even one plane, much less four, you know, how are they going to get into the cockpit? How are they going to try to make sure that they don't squawk the hijack code, which takes about 2 or 3 seconds? And then why don't we have the slightest shred of evidence that any of these guys were actually on any of the planes? Where are all of the security videos? There should have been huge numbers of security videos showing these guys at all four of the airports. There is not one authentic image of any of these alleged 19 hijackers at any of these airports. There's not one ticket stub, not one authenticated passenger list. There is none of the evidence that would have been all over the world's media the next day. I think it's just that, again, that alone, along with all these other things. I mean, how many times do we have to prove that there are no hijackers?
Well, I agree with you. It's suspicious. I agree with that. The fact that 93 may have been blown up, and there may have been bombs on the plane. You know, this guy who called from the washroom, that might have been a real cell phone call. I'm convinced it was. And he said the plane had been hijacked. There had been an explosion on the plane. He was terrified. You know, he was. It was not one of those calm.
That was 93, right?
This is 93. Yeah. This is at 9:58. Mm-hmm. The plane was probably only about 5,000 feet.
And that's like the only one, or one of like the only two or something,
yes,
that the FBI says were real. Like,
that's
originally
right.
The FBI went along with the story that there were, what, 17 or something cell phone calls. Right. And then
they backed off.
Yeah, they backed off because Dudeney did that research, proved there couldn't have been any cell phone calls from altitude. So they backed way off, but they tried to keep like a couple of alleged calls from the lower altitude.
Yeah, and that one to me, there was a connection was to the 911 operator in the county just west of where Flight 93 went down. So it seemed to me to be a plausible call,
they faked more than a dozen calls, but there's one that's real.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was real, and because it just rang true. You know, this guy was terrified.
If we have a dozen proven faked calls, like you've got a serious, burden of proof here. that just seems so. It's way out on a limb.
But there's other evidence that the plane did explode. There were people on the ground at Indian Lake who saw debris trailing behind the plane. Mm-hmm. And there's I don't know if you know this, but Warren Stutt, a 9/11 investigator, obtained the data files for, I think he has the data files for both Flight 77 and 93, and there's a black box in the rear of the plane that has a longitudinal data recording, and failed in the case of Flight 93 failed to record a deceleration when the plane supposedly hit the ground. Okay, so there was no sudden deceleration. What does that tell you? Maybe the plane exploded before it hit, Mm-hmm. In the case of Flight 77, there was a very sudden deceleration when it hit that impact wall. Mm-hmm. That was a Kevlar reinforced blast wall there in the west wing of the Pentagon that was destroyed on 9/11. That had just been completed.
So you're taking the position that the I know there are questions raised about the authenticity of the data and the Flight 77 black box, but you would accept that it's authentic data from an actual airliner that actually crashed at the Pentagon on the flight path that we were told?
I'm afraid so, Kevin. I think the Flight 77 hit. Have you ever seen that composite photo of the impact zone? It was much larger than that small hole we first learned about, and people concluded it had been a rocket. It was a very large hole, large enough to accommodate a 757. And this never got any attention on the internet. I'm not even sure if it was ever posted on the internet. I'd be happy to send you that composite. You can take it.
Yeah, please do. I mean, I probably have seen it, but then I've also seen all kinds of other arguments. Some of the reasons for thinking that this probably didn't happen that way include the fact that this would be such a difficult flight path to approach the Pentagon
It would be extremely difficult for a pilot, mm-hmm. and impossible for a novice like Hani Hanger, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But if it was a remote control operation, hey, they could do that.
That's the argument. Yeah, you get people who say that with the remote control they could be hitting these targets with accuracy at these extremely high speeds, flying these very, very precision paths. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I know Pilots for 9/11 Truth doesn't agree with that.
Well, I'm willing to concede that they have a strong argument with those planes that hit the World Trade Center. They were way beyond their envelope. What they were designed for. Mm-hmm. That's a serious problem for the official story. That's really, really suspicious about those two planes and makes me wonder if there was a switch. Mm-hmm. However, I got to tell you that the Pilots for 9/11 Truth, they've been wrong as often as they've been right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're aware of this, right?
Well, they were wrong. I know that there's been a lot of debate. Which are the key issues where you think they've been wrong?
I think they've been wrong on three issues, okay? They were wrong when they claimed that that the data indicated that the plane flew over the Pentagon. Remember that story?
Yeah.
They argued that the evidence indicated that the plane flew over. However, Farmer, he looked at that and he suspected that all the data files had not been properly, they had not pulled the data out of those data files properly when they decoded those black boxes, and
pilots or
no, this was the National Transportation Safety Board, I believe. So there was some kind of error that happened, And when Frank Legg, you know, the editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and Warren Studd looked at this, Studd is one of these guys. He's one of these computer wizards, you know, software wizards. And he got into those files and actually pulled out the rest of the data. And when you plug it in, it lines up with it with an impact at the impact point of the Pentagon. And they did a paper on this. It's up there at the Journal of 9/11 Studies. I don't know. I've yet to run anybody who's even read it.
Okay. So the pilots haven't looked at that yet?
Nah. Look, no. There was another issue. Balsamo claimed that the cockpit door was never opened from Flight 77.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that's bullshit. Farmer took a look at this and found out that the previous flights of the – he got his hands on the data from the previous flights from Flight 77, and the same problem existed, which tells us that this was some kind of a sensor problem. Mm-hmm. There was some kind of a malfunction. Okay? And the other issue, Balsamo claims – he has posted on his website – evidence that Flight 93 was still in the air, you know, and flew south over Shanksville and crashed somewhere down in Maryland.
Now, I don't know about the Maryland crash part. I haven't seen that, but I have seen their claim that two of the planes were still in the air. Was it 77 and 93, was it? Or no, it was...
I think 93, I'm not sure what the... Maybe 175.
Yeah, 175, I think.
I'm not sure of the other one. But anyway, that data is not primary source data. That was secondary data. Not as reliable. The reliable data is the air traffic control tapes and the radar data, which dovetails and I think it more or less proves that Flight 93 did end its flight there north of Shanksville.
Okay, interesting. Well, maybe I can get Rob or somebody back on to give their perspective on this. Maybe they need to actually look at some of these critiques first.
Well, good luck there. You know, I went up on the pilot's site and posted just a small part of this, and Rob Balsamo took down my post, banned me from the site, and sent me insulting emails. So he's not open to even discussing it, I don't think.
Okay. Well, yeah, we haven't had him on the show for several years now. Yeah, he's for various reasons, he hasn't come on the show. I don't think it's that he's disagreeing with anything I've said, but who knows?
I can't. You'd have to ask him.
Yeah, there are a lot of people in this business who get way too prickly and too attached to their egos and interpret something and get very upset, feel threatened or angry when somebody disagrees with them.
Yeah.
I try not to follow that path.
I know. I'm the same way. I've made mistakes and I've acknowledged them, you know.
Yeah. So that anyway, very, very interesting stuff. So you're going back to this is a scenario that I did hear back in the day, the hijacked hijacker scenario. But you know, again, when you are a big picture person, as we both are, you know, you look at this, you ask who gains, and we come down on pretty much the same side here, obviously. And in particular, it seems just so obvious that Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, which are both U.S., not quite puppet states. In the case of Saudi Arabia, they're pretty close to being a real 100% puppet state. Pakistan, I don't know, maybe 95% puppet state. I mean, they were the Cold War proxy against India and Russia for all those years, and they ran the Mujahideen fighting the Russians on behalf of the U.S. So they're our guys, right? So the question would be like, okay, so we've got these indications that there are people from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia involved in 9/11, these kinds of, you know, things that look like setups, right? Right. We had the top Pakistani guy from ISI sending money to Mohammed Atta right before 9/11. And we had this princess from Saudi Arabia sending money to alleged hijackers. You know, what's going on here? Does Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or anybody there have the slightest reason to want something like 9/11 to happen? No, it's the opposite. Everybody there except for the complete sellouts, and there are always a few sellouts, and psychopaths were willing to take American money to sell out their countries, and there are people like that in leadership positions in these two countries, but in terms of anybody who has the slightest care for any authentic national interest in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, they absolutely would not want something like 9/11 to happen, because what it did was it empowered Bush and the American juggernaut to say, you know, to the Saudis, you told us that you were going to leave our imperial orbit in August of 2001. Well, guess what? You're not, because we're going to nuke Mecca and Riyadh if you do. And we can suspect that that happened, but we can be sure that that happened with Pakistan because we heard it from Musharraf himself, who said that Bush threatened to nuke Pakistan back to the Stone Age if Musharraf didn't follow his orders after 9/11. So that's what 9/11 did. It turned both of these semi-slave states into complete slave states enslaved to the Zionist-controlled United States. The idea that anybody, any Muslims, anybody from Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, would have the slightest interest in carrying off this event that would completely destroy everything that they've ever wanted to accomplish is ludicrous. And yet we still have this kind of talk that, oh, they, you know, those princes supported the hijackers and this Pakistani guy wired money to Ada, yada, 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 yada. Obviously a setup by the Zionists. Am I wrong?
Well, I have to agree with you. It that's very fishy and it could well be a setup. The money from that Pakistani general, that report came through an Indian paper, newspaper, you know.
Right.
So that's also suspect.
No kidding. Well, yeah, because the Israeli intelligence, Indian intelligence are wedded at the hip, and of course the Israelis have the upper hand there. So yeah, we pretty much know who told you that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm afraid that could well be set up.
Yeah, it's very strange how unsophisticated people just have this idea, oh, those Muslims, they just really hate us, and so they would just go out and do these things that totally work against their own interests. You know, and of course, we've heard the opposite argument that those of us who would say that Hani Hanjour was incapable of piloting a Cessna, so obviously he didn't pilot 77. We're told, oh, we're racist bigots who don't think that Arabs are capable of accomplishing anything. If we think it was the Mossad rather than the Arabs, we must be racist bigots.
Because that's right. These are the blowback people, right?
Yeah.
They think that, oh, this was an attack trying to get back at us. Well, I don't.
Yeah, but if you believe that you know they're such geniuses that they could pull off this incredible, spectacular attack, defeating all of these defenses, sneaking around all of our intelligence people, all of our allies' intelligence people, and somehow pull this off, and using these two planes destroy these three huge skyscrapers, what geniuses! And they're such geniuses that everything they're doing is completely undermining their cause. So they must be the world's stupidest geniuses.
This is why the evidence for explosives at the World Trade Center is so important. This is so important because obviously, this rules out any Muslim operation.
Well, that's not what Chomsky told me. Chomsky insisted that even if we prove that these were demolitions, it would just mean that bin Laden did it. That's directly from his email to me.
I have an exchange with Chomsky that is just as irrational as that.
Really? Yeah. Why could that be?
Well, I'd be happy to share those emails with you if you want to look at them.
Yeah, sure.
David Ray Griffin also had the same reaction in an exchange with Chomsky. Obviously, Chomsky, this is something he can't talk about. He can't go there. Obviously, he knows that the Israelis were somehow involved, or he knows or suspects, and it's just something he can't go to. He can't talk about.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's – do you think he's – like actually pro-Israel at some level? He has said that the most meaningful and wonderful time of his life was when he spent a year on a kibbutz when he was young. Or do you think maybe he's afraid that if the truth comes out, then not just Israel, but the Jewish people will suddenly find themselves behind the eight ball?
I wish I knew the answer, Kevin. I've had communication with Chomsky going back many years, and I had tremendous respect for the guy. And so it's so disappointing to see him, behave this way on the 9/11 issue. But it must have to do with the fact that at rock bottom, he is a Zionist still, even though he's very critical of the, of the leadership of Israel.
Indeed. Yeah, it's frustrating, how much stupidity this 9/11 thing has spread into so many places, beyond what you ever could have imagined. People like Chomsky saying these nonsensical things. In a way, it seems like, that's one of the most profoundly disturbing aspects of 9/11 was the way it shut down thinking. It really dumbed down this country beyond anything I ever could have imagined.
I totally agree, and it's very disheartening and depressing. And I've been fighting against that, you know, ever since I came late to this issue. I didn't even start investigating 9/11 until 2006.
Right.
But, you know, I've been fighting that trend. And it is very disturbing. People have stopped thinking. I know personal friends from college, you know, guys who are radicals in college who basically just can't talk about it. You know, they just write it off.
Mm-hmm. Paul Craig Roberts has a terrific new piece about this, actually, in which the second half of his piece, what's it called? It's up at his website, paulcraigroberts.org. It's called "There's No Freedom Without Truth." And he goes into this beautiful rant about, you know, how can people not get this? You know, he talks about the contributors to this new book, Another French False Flag. And he's, of course, one of those contributors. I edited this book. And right. Paul Craig Roberts says, 24 of these contributors do not believe the official story. Does that make them conspiracy theorists? What incentive to the, you know, A.K. Dewdney, professor emeritus at University of Western Ontario, author of 10 books about science and mathematics, what incentive does he have to be a conspiracy theorist? How about Phil Giraldi, the former CIA case officer, Tony Hall, the University of Lethbridge globalization studies guy whose latest book has been called a scholarly tour de force by the American Library Association? I don't know. He lists all of these very, very reputable people who are risking their reputations by telling the truth about these false flags. And he concludes by saying, the neocons whores in the Western media who call these people conspiracy theorists are so stupid and unintelligent as to be unqualified to express any opinion.
Yeah, I like. You have to love Paul Craig Roberts' take on this. He's great.
Yeah, yeah.
I read him all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not pulling any punches on this, and it is frustrating. I mean, we're living in an asylum where the inmates have obviously taken over. Maybe it's not an insane asylum. It's just a stupid asylum.
Well, obviously the extraterrestrials are looking down at us, wondering where the intelligent life is, you know.
indeed. Yeah. Well, and there are people actually in this movement who think that there's some kind of ET connection here, that, you know, if we can show ourselves an intelligent species, then there'll be some kind of contact. I imagine you probably haven't looked into that too deeply.
Well, I think, you know, for that to happen, we have to get our own house in order, and that's we're a long way from there.
Indeed. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end of the show, and maybe we should once more just kind of sum up your article. Basically, is I think taking a couple of steps further down the path towards getting on board with those of us who've been saying that these neocon hardline Zionists really are quite obviously the not just the suspects, but the perpetrators here.
Yes, and I think that we need to focus on the World Trade Center collapse, and we need to focus on the issue, the fact that it was demolished, and follow the, just start connecting dots. You know, people can take this, you know, they can work on this on their own. I mean, just start connecting dots and start doing research. The listeners out there, you know, just work on it. Take it and run with it.
Indeed. The truth is out there. The material is out there. And your book is out there, Black 9/11, Money, Motive, and Technology. And you have a second edition coming out with some revisions?
That's right. The second edition will be out later this year, I think around the 9/11 date. And it's going to have the updated breakthrough analysis of Flight 93 and also a discussion about the National Reconnaissance shutdown. Couple extra chapters.
Cool. Yeah. And let's remind the listeners what that was. The National Reconnaissance Office, which does satellite surveillance,
was
having a drill, and the drill was imagining a plane plunging into their office.
That's right.
A plane into building exercise.
This was minutes from the you know, when the Pentagon was hit. Just minutes.
Right. And so this was used as an excuse, apparently, to perhaps prevent those people in that office who might have had access to satellite imagery showing what the planes were actually doing from being able to see it? Is that a possibility?
Well, that's definitely a possibility. Yeah, I raise that. That's the issue I raise.
Yeah, I would think so. And there have been all kinds of stories that Putin has his hands on some Russian satellite photos or other evidence that could blow 9/11 wide open. Have you seen that speculation?
I get up to the veterans today once in a while and have seen some things up there, but I would love to see that. Has that now has that been made available to veterans today yet?
Well, yeah, you know, at VT, what I've seen is, like, I think I published a purely speculative piece just pointing out that whenever the conflict with Russia ramps up, the Russians tend to get a little more outspoken about 9/11. I gave several examples of that, including that documentary that was released on 9/11 called 9/11 and Operation Gladio, which went viral and so on and so forth. They had to use some kind of NSA technology to stop it from going mega viral, and on and on and on. So I did a speculative
piece. Is that still available?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Anybody can pull up 9/11 and Operation Gladio.
Okay. Because I have not seen that.
Yeah. It's there. It was heading for millions of views a couple of years ago, right before the anniversary. And suddenly something happened, and people who emailed the URL found that their emails disappeared into a black hole and never reached the recipient, nor did they bounce. And all of the search engines just lost it. It suddenly stopped showing up on search engines, including YouTube search engine, which is what drives things viral. So they were able to stop it from going mega viral, and it merely went viral. So anyway, yeah, Putin is probably sitting on something. And as far as the specifics, I think the hardest evidence we have that there was something there was when this came out in, was it Sputnik? One of the Russian media outlets said something about this. So that was the big, that was why VT splashed it around. But I don't think, as far as I know, I don't have any inside information from Putin himself or anything like that.
Right. Well, let's hope they do release it.
Okay. Putin, if you're listening to Truth Jihad Radio, and I certainly hope you are through a translator, release those satellite photos. And thank you, Mark Gaffney. I appreciate your very interesting and worthwhile research. Look forward to that new edition of Black 9/11, and hope to talk again sometime.
Okay, Kevin. It's been fun.
All right. Likewise. Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
Bye.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire, and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Well, a curly-headed girl with a bright, shiny smile heard the roar of a plane as it sailed through the sky. To her playmate she said with a bright, twinkling eye, "My daddy flies that ship in the sky. My daddy flies that ship in the sky. Well, my daddy flies that ship in the sky. Mama's not afraid, and neither am I. My daddy flies that ship in the sky." Then a pug-nosed kid, as he kicked up his heel, said, "My daddy works in that iron and the steel. Yes, my dad builds planes so they fly through the sky, and that's what keeps your daddy up there so high. That's what keeps your daddy up there so high. That's what keeps your daddy up there so high. My dad builds planes so they fly through the sky, and that's what keeps your daddy up there so high." Then a freckle-faced boy pinched his toe in the sand, said, "My daddy works at that place where they land. So you tell your mama, don't be afraid, 'cause my dad'll bring your daddy back home again. My dad'll bring your daddy back home again. My dad'll bring your daddy back home again. Don't be afraid if it gets dark and rains, 'cause my dad'll bring your daddy back home again."